The Mincing Rascals podcast is sponsored by Ottawa, Illinois, the middle of everywhere. This fall, as the leaves are changing, get outdoors and enjoy some relaxation. Plan your trip today. Log on to visitottawail.com.
Today is Wednesday. It's September 4th, 2024. It's 2:41 in the afternoon. Hello, this is John Williams. Thanks for finding the Mincing Rascals podcast. We broadcast portions of this on WGN Radio Saturday nights at 8. Tell your friends about us. Give us a good rating and listen for me weekdays on WGN from 10 to 2.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute and co-founder of Iron Light, a marketing agency working to change the world. And you can check out my book, The New Chicago Way.
I'm Marge Halperin, a longtime journalist, government reform worker, communications consultant, now pundit, doing what I can to challenge authority.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, a fine weekly Substack newsletter. And most importantly this week, the father of the groom. My son's getting married on Saturday.
Oh, hey. Oh,
congratulations.
Your son's getting married on Saturday.
Yes.
So you're going to give a speech Friday night?
I'm giving a speech Saturday after the wedding during the toasts is my assignment.
Okay. Are you not the best man, though, are you?
Well, you mean literally.
Yes, I know, Eric. You're the best man. But usually at a rehearsal dinner, the father of the groom, at least that's my understanding, that was our routine, would give a toast. Well, but you're going to give a speech at some point.
I'm going to give a speech at some point, yes. I thought I'd have AI do it because, you know, which says, you know, insert son's name here. I'll just do that,
so. Are you going to cry? Sure you're going to cry.
I probably
I'm going to cry.
It's really something. We're really happy about it.
How many people?
About 80, I think, is the final
nice.
Count.
So.
Great. Are you doing it in Chicago?
No, we're doing it out in La Porte, Indiana. There's an orchard out there, and there's going to be some old-time music played there. We're inviting guests to bring their fiddles and banjos and guitars, and that's not the main music of the event, but there will be some.
A friend of mine's kid is getting married in Italy, in Tuscany, because why not? You're not doing that.
Yeah. No, we're not, although it is a semi-destination wedding. It's, what, about an hour and a half out of Chicago.
Laporte, Tuscany.
A little bit of a hassle to get people there. We got a lot of people coming in from out of town. But, you know, it's a beautiful setting, and it'll be a beautiful day.
So. Yeah. Good for you.
In my experience, you probably have the skill to deliver without crying, but look out afterward.
Yeah, right. When my son got married, Brenda and I regretted that as busy. Here's some advice, Eric. Thanks for asking. We regretted that we were so busy accommodating everybody and kibitzing that we never took the time, Brenda and I, to share in the moment. In fact, we didn't get a picture of the two of us together. The wedding reception, we were together for hours that day. Brenda and I didn't get a good picture together. Take time for you and Johanna to cherish the moment. You know what I mean?
I'm sure we will. I wanted to ask Austin, who is the most recently married of all of us. It was last year, wasn't it, Austin?
It's almost 2 years.
2 years? Man, yeah. Time flies. But did your father speak? And at what point did he say anything?
My mother spoke. Our rehearsal dinner, my younger brother spoke. At the wedding, it was my mother mostly. My father had a couple words, but it was mostly my mom. And which is interesting because my dad is very fond of public speaking, but my mom kind of took the lead. And I remember one of my close friends, Allison, came up to me later and she goes, "I did not know that you got your sense of humor from your mother." And I thought, oh, that's nice. I never thought about that either. It's true.
If you could get your mom to send me her speech, I can just change a few of the names.
Are you going to read it or work off bullet points, Eric?
I think it's going to be short enough that I'll basically read it, but I'll have it mostly memorized. So,
at my son's wedding, his brother, my other son, gave the best man speech. And Griffin can do that, but that's not been his routine. And so he stood there, and he was holding his note in his hand, and it was going like this. And he would pause, and you could see and hear the paper rattle. And It's like, get a grip, son. And then people started to cheer for him, like, we're here for you, Griff. And Griffin really gave a very funny speech. It was thoughtful, and I won't say it shocked us all, but we didn't know what was going to happen. And here's another thing, Eric, we don't have the video of that. So make sure you get the video of that.
Get a good photographer, really. I will say this, Eric, you'll never play to a better house.
It's a good room.
Yeah.
Hot room.
Very, well, very warm.
Congratulations in advance. Here we go now. You can't carry a gun into a stadium, an airplane, a courthouse. Should the law prohibit people, even those who have a concealed carry license, from carrying a gun onto a CTA bus or train? A judge in Rockford this week, the same week that four people were shot to death on an L car, in a couple of cars, a judge in Rockford said prohibiting that from carrying a weapon onto CTA would cross a constitutional line. It would violate one's Second Amendment rights. Citing the Bruin decision, the judge said that the defendants, quote, failed to meet their burden to show an American tradition of firearm regulation at the time of the Founding Fathers that would allow Illinois to prohibit plaintiffs who hold concealed carry permits from carrying concealed handguns for self-defense onto the CTA and Metra. That's a lot of words there, but it goes back to that Founding Fathers. What's the tradition of firearms in the country? And this judge in Rockford said that you ought to be able to carry a concealed weapon onto the L.
Seems like the correct decision in terms of the law. And I think it's going to be very difficult for people who think that a solution to the violence on the CTA is going to be banning guns on the CTA, because I don't think it will pass constitutional muster, regardless of whether you think that's a good idea for reducing violence. But it makes sense, right? If you have a concealed carry permit and you have a car, you're allowed to carry your weapon in your car. But maybe if you're lower income and don't have a car and you're riding public transportation, your Second Amendment rights would not be infringed. So what's interesting is there the CTA on a parallel track, so to speak, is testing out this artificial intelligence technology that would take camera footage and be able to surmise whether someone was carrying a weapon onto the CTA. And the ACLU has raised some civil liberty concerns about that. So that in absence of being able to take to tell people you can't bring your gun on the train, I think the CTA is trying to come up with a technological solution, but may run into a different sort of civil liberties problem.
What part of concealed carry does that new technology not understand? That people are going to be bringing guns in there. I mean, I'm assuming they're going to be in a waistband. It's not going to show up on a screen, on a video screen. If you subscribe to the whole concealed carry idea, which is pretty settled law, the idea that as Austin says, like a lower income person who has to take the bus, can't drive a car to get from place to place and feels like they need that protection when they arrive there, is forbidden from taking his or her gun with them on that trip. But it is kind of a close call, because we are certainly fine with the idea of not allowing people to bring their guns into sporting arenas and to schools, into bars. We understand that guns are dangerous, and they're dangerous in crime. We can't bring them into courthouses. We can't bring them into the General Assembly. There's many places that forbid us to have guns, because we understand that there's this inherent danger in them. So is the CTA train analogous to that? To a crowded situation where a gun is just going to be a lot of trouble, and if so, is there a way around this? I think it's sort of a paradox here because we the law, the Constitution recognizes the right to self-defense, but doesn't recognize that right in certain situations, and the question becomes whether this is one of them.
I'd hate to see this start us down the path of looking at whether it's paid for with public funds or not, which is one of the things that is mentioned in the coverage of this case. That way, college campuses that are state universities might have to allow them, but private universities wouldn't. We own Soldier Field publicly. Does that mean that people could start carrying handguns there? That's a bad path. And I got to say, when I saw this decision, which I did not see until after I saw the news of the horrible shooting on the Blue Line the day after. But as I caught up with this, my first reaction is the Supreme Court's ruining our country and making it a dangerous place. There's two things that were in this story that were of interest to me. One is, in one of the versions, the version I saw on WTTW's page, they characterized the judge's decision as saying, quote, well, it's not quoting him, but the story says this, under current U.S. Supreme Court standards, the law violates the Second Amendment of the Constitution, which is to say that the Supreme Court, current Supreme Court, in so many ways, I feel, has set their own standards. This kind of acknowledges that in this case, because the Second Amendment doesn't speak to our militia, your right for self-defense, which is the second point in the story that's disturbing to me, because the attorney for the plaintiffs say, make this suggestion you see over and over again, that now it'll deter crime because aggressors would be wary that potential victims could have a gun. Right now, he says, quote, criminals have, it seems, felt pretty comfortable knowing people wouldn't be able to resist or fight back. When law enforcement around the country at every level is uniform in saying this is more dangerous, not less. If there's a shooting on a train and a police officer makes his or her way onto the car, and lots of people have guns, they don't know who's the victim and who's the criminal in this case, and who started it and who's going to end it. Everybody's carrying guns. They don't know who to protect from whom, and it causes chaos. And it is not safer for people to carry guns. That fallacy, which apparently is also rooted in the thinking of the current Supreme Court, I believe is very dangerous for all of us.
Well, as a practical matter, you're in a confined space and you're not 30,000 feet in the air. And if somebody pulls a gun on you on a train car, and I will for a moment just not think about everybody else on the train car, Marge, but if I had a gun and they're robbing me or mugging the person next to me or pointing a gun at someone, that is your failsafe. I mean, to me, that's the purpose of concealed carry.
That is what they say is the purpose, but it doesn't play out that way, well, according to law enforcement.
I don't know. It just seems to me like maybe it would in my case, right? Like, I'd like to make that decision when somebody is beating people up on my train car or coming after me. I don't know that I would have the balls to shoot somebody, to be honest with you. I've never fired. I fired a gun once. Of all things, it was a machine gun, but but
really?
I know it was a Tommy gun that was once owned by one of the Chicagoland gangsters, and they held it at the jail in Indiana, and I was over there, and they said, you want to shoot the original machine gun? Anyway, so that was kind of cool, but it would seem to me like a person who is responsible and in danger and adept with a gun should have the right to defend themselves in that situation.
I wouldn't want to be in the crossfire in that situation.
I wouldn't want you to be, but I'm only thinking about me in this situation. I'm the one with the gun. Really, I'm not being coy with you here.
I understand, and it does not make me feel safer to know there could be lots of guns firing in a second.
The situation that comes to mind is, imagine really the state of your day-to-day life in the city of Chicago if you feel as though it is necessary for your safety to bring a gun onto the train. And that is a very difficult life most of the time. And I think it would be wise for us to consider the types of people who would be prosecuted and arrested and imprisoned for this kind of enforcement. It will be overwhelmingly low-income Black people, Black men on the train who are carrying a weapon for some for their own safety. Now, if we take it in aggregate, is it making everybody safer that they have weapons on the train? I probably agree with Marge. It's not. But I think the effects of enforcing something like this would continue to put people in prison for a pretty long time for something that they are doing to address a public safety failure on the part of the city of Chicago.
Well, we can't put a cop on every train.
Certainly not.
But well,
you can have a public safety environment where people feel safer in their communities, and that criminals are who are wielding guns and killing people are there's a higher clearance rate and people are going to prison. There's trust between law enforcement and the community such that people feel less of a need to be arming themselves on the red line, which is a scary proposition, certainly.
We used to have conductors walking the trains. Police officers could do that too, and you don't know when someone's going to walk into the car. But I felt it kept them cleaner as well as safer. And I know that was a budget cut, and we could talk about budgets and will in a little bit, I think. CTA doesn't have a lot of money for personnel, but I don't think that cutting those folks who would have a presence on the train was in our best interest.
Of course, this happens right at a time when we have this horrible murder of four people on the Blue Line train out in Forest Park. Apparently, there were four people who were unhoused, and they're sleeping on the train, and some guy just comes in and shoots them and basically executes them. But I don't know that gun crime itself has been a real problem on the CTA particularly.
No.
It's going to kind of a bit of ironic timing. But as John pointed out, this is a system, and Dorval Carter said that, you know, they have 145 rail stations, 1,500 rail cars, 1,800 buses, 10,000 bus stops. It's really, really difficult to imagine finding funding to put conductors or security people on every bus or on every car, on the trains or in every station. It's a monumentally expensive task, and so it. Like I said, I think this falls right in the middle where you're kind of, you know, it doesn't even really matter how you feel about concealed carry. I mean, if you're opposed to concealed carry, you don't want it anywhere. But if you're basically okay with the idea of concealed carry, this has got to fall in right into the spot where you're not exactly sure whether it's a good idea or not.
I don't know if I still have some PTSD from the mugging that took place on a train car I was in a few years ago, but I think about the people who 2 or 3 in the morning are coming back from or going to a job where they don't have a car. You can imagine some employee at a donut shop or some public service facility, and the shifts are at odd hours. People are on the train for legitimate reasons at 2 in the morning. And, you know, we all throw our hands up going, well, you're just asking for trouble. That shouldn't be your only option. That's why I think if you have a gun and it's 2:30 in the morning and that's how you get home on Saturday, I think that's fair for you. You know, like every time you hear about one of these crimes, it's 5 a.m. on a Sunday or it's on the far south side on a platform that you wouldn't be caught on by accident. Shoot, if they had a gun, they could have tried to save themselves.
On the same day, I believe this was Labor Day, this was at 1 in the afternoon, there was a stabbing on the Wilson Red Line.
Yeah, that's my stop.
Yeah, that's equally frightening. But I take your point, John. I think that's exactly the type of situation where I would not begrudge someone for taking matters into their own hands and trying to protect themselves if that's the way they need to get to work.
There's a study that came out in July by the RAND company that does independent research that says there's supportive evidence that concealed carry laws may increase total homicides, firearm homicides, and violent crime. Effect of permitless carry laws is inconclusive, interestingly. I just think this is one of those things where there's a sense about what is clear, obvious, common sense, but in the actual, the way it actually plays out is not consistent with what you would think. It makes people more dangerous to have more guns around them, which to me is common sense. And I understand your perspective, John, because you think you'd be in control of your gun. So do all those other people who pull a gun and it goes wrong.
You are listening to The Mincing Rascals, and our conversation continues after a quick message from Ottawa, Illinois, the middle of everywhere. Surrounded by open spaces and rivers and trails, Ottawa is a natural setting that allows you to get outdoors and enjoy some fall relaxation. Settle down and snuggle up in one of Ottawa's nearly 400 rooms. Everything from established hotels to luxury resorts, private rentals, B&Bs. Plan your fall trip today today at visitottawail.com. Brought to you by Ottawa, the middle of everywhere, and the Illinois Office of Tourism. Okay, I do want to talk a little bit about the city budget, and for that matter, the school board negotiation and how that's going on right now. Austin, just catch us up on what we need to know about those subjects and how they're related.
Sure. So CTU and CPS have been in bargaining for the last several months, including some open bargaining sessions, which the CTU has been very proud of being able to bring into the light for the first time. They often say they're doing this bargaining on the city's front lawn or front yard. And in that open bargaining, it was revealed last month in one of those sessions, an official from Chicago Public Schools was showing for the first time what would happen to the Chicago Public Schools budget deficit should they accept some of the demands of the union, and specifically showed that the deficit right now is about $500 million. And if they accepted just around 50 of the 700 demands from the CTU, that budget deficit would balloon to over $4 billion. And the response from Jackson Potter, who's the vice president of the Chicago Teachers Union, after being shown those numbers in this opening bargaining session was very interesting. He said something like, you know, when you show a slide like that, it makes it seem like you're not going to accept any of our demands. And indeed, just right after that open bargaining session, the president of the union, Stacey Davis Gates, came out and called Pedro Martinez, the head of the school's insubordinate. And then news broke, I believe it was the next day on a Friday, from WBEZ Sun-Times, saying that the mayor was looking to fire Pedro Martinez. The reasons for that firing, I think, include the fact that for the first time, Chicago Public Schools is saying we have a massive budget deficit and here's how the contract would affect it. It's also being called for because Pedro Martinez himself and informed the school board, both of them rejected efforts from the mayor and the CTU to take out what was effectively a very high interest payday loan of $300 million to tide the district over while they lobby for more money from Springfield. This is especially ironic because the union's big kind of marketing push over the last month has been, why isn't Chicago Public Schools going after these rapacious, horrible bank deals and contracts? And we're paying so much in interest and paying so much to these banks that could be going into classrooms, while at the same time, for political reasons, pressuring the school district to take out a loan that was a $300 million loan to kind of get over the hump for just by a few months. We're going to be paying for that for 20 years, paying over $700 million on that debt. So right now you have a really interesting nesting doll that's taking place where the district is facing a $500 million deficit, not even accounting for the new CTU contract, and they're asking for more money. The city is facing, now we know, $1 billion budget deficit. And the state is not in a great position in the spring to be able to bail this out. So these nesting dolls, it's kind of all coming to a head because federal money is running out. And I've talked to a lot of people about this. It's really not clear to me how Chicago Public Schools kind of gets out of this mess. I'll stop there, but there's just a lot of dynamics at play here.
Aren't they getting an offer of 4 years, 4 or 5% per year, which I know isn't the only issue on the table, but that would be the first issue for me if I'm an employee and I'm trying to pay my bills.
So, and the union came out and said they were very unhappy about that because it did include lots of other demands that they had. And of course, the organizing model right now, the Chicago Teachers Union, for the last 10, 12 years has been, it's about much, much more than wages and benefits. It's about a lot of social demands, a lot more different kinds of staffing, green schools, like housing for teachers, lots of other demands.
Not all of them are unreasonable either, by the way. I think comfortable schools and better staffing and more enriched staffing is a good idea, but I get your point. How are you going to pay for any of this?
Yes. At the risk of someone who of being accused, like Austin has been, of stalking Stacey Davis Gates by quoting her, she did say recently, and I think I've said several times, that the budget problems of the city of Chicago and CPS are not her job to deal with. That she, her job as head of the union, is to issue demands and argue for changes and not to talk money. And she's made some dismissive comments about that. And it feels to me like a little toxic, frankly, to be telling taxpayers and telling people in the city that they don't care where the money comes from. They just want the money. And I know that I'm not trying to paint teachers as greedy necessarily. I think that their salary demands seem fairly in line with the way things have been going. 4% a year compounded for 4 years is pretty good, probably going to outpace inflation. But I do think that the union seems to need a reality check. Like, okay, let's talk about where this money is going to come from. Are we going to increase property taxes? Because that's what Mayor Johnson is talking about to deal with this massive city debt. But, you know, he said some sacrifices need to be made. Are we talking about program cuts elsewhere? Where is all this money coming from? And I'm saying this as someone who supports public education, tends to support teachers' unions. But I do think it's important to, when you're having conversations like this, to talk about, okay, who's going to pay for this? How's it going to happen? Because Springfield is not going to bail them out. I think it's pretty clear.
I think this is the wrong conversation, and there's no end to this line of conversation. We need more staffing in the schools. Teachers deserve more money, or whatever the qualities are, the issues are that the teachers are asking for. The answer is always, we don't have enough money, because there has not ever, at least in the decades I've lived in Chicago, there's never been adequate funding to run the school system. And it's to take the usual phrase in reverse, it's too big to succeed. I've said this before, there has to be a whole different way to look at it. There has to be a way to structure the services that are not one giant school district, because it's a never-ending argument over money. And I think it's unfortunate the union has chosen a rather belligerent way to say so. It's like, I don't care where the money comes from, you just have to get it. Well, you know, as a resident here, I agree with that. We just have to find the money, but we have to find the structure that will support good schools in every neighborhood in the city, given some of the almost insurmountable inequities that exist in the schools. They've done it year after year by cutting key staff. Where my daughter teaches, you know, they didn't have an assistant principal. Another school, they don't have a clerk. Another school doesn't have counseling, or the nurse comes in once a week. When my daughter was in school and needed an EpiPen because of an allergy, they locked it up in the office and said, if the nurse is here that day, she can have it. Like, they just, over the years, these are decades of inadequate funding. So why are we still trying to make a system work that is clearly unworkable?
There is intransigence on the union's part to reimagine these things in a way that would be good for everyone. So, for example, a third of Chicago public schools are less than half full. So we're paying tons of money for buildings rather than students. And that is just such an antiquated way to look at education. And yet the union has lobbied very, very, very heavily to not allow for the repurposing of any of those buildings or efficiencies to be gained there to increase classroom funding. Instead, it's only about more money. And I think the word belligerent is completely correct. And what we're seeing and will increasingly see, Stacey Davis Gates called this out to Fran Spielman in her interview recently, where she's just directly attacking Governor Pritzker as saying he doesn't, you know, essentially care about poor kids in the city of Chicago, which, if her beef with Pedro Martinez is that he's not working hard enough to get state money, that is absolutely the worst possible way to try to advocate for more state money, is to take that kind of messaging and marketing approach.
Closed schools is an interesting example, and a good one, Austin, because past mayors who saw this reality, and I was a consultant to the school board when the first proposal started to come out, and I understood the budgeting issue. But the idea was close the building and send the kids somewhere else out of the neighborhood. They missed the important message there. If this is not the right way to serve kids in a nearly empty school that we can't afford to keep, heated in the winter, what is the right way to give them a quality education? And that's a discussion we never had. They just shut the schools. And I think moving them to another neighborhood and giving them, you know, security guards so they could cross gang lines or something was a very poorly thought out plan. But there is a way to serve those kids in the schools you identify. There's all these conversations that we're not having. I think we need to stop repeating the dead end conversations of decades and look at things in a fresh way.
Well, what would that involve? Marjorie, I'm not sure where you came down exactly on closing some of these schools, but you have these huge buildings with handfuls of students in them. And the rationale for keeping them open is that these are community-based, they're anchors in communities and so on. It seems like, I mean, I agree with that point. I mean, when I grew up, I lived about 4 or 5 blocks away from my elementary school and about another 10 blocks from my junior high. And it was really nice to be in the neighborhood, be able to walk to school and see my neighbors at school and so on. That was ideal. But we have some really tough decisions to make. And is one of those decisions like, well, we're going to have to, if we want quality schools, that maybe we can't have as many neighborhood schools. And the idea of closing schools just freaks people right out. When Rahm Emanuel closed 50 schools, people used to mention that in the first line of their beefs against him.
Still do.
And I'm sure Brandon Johnson won't be on board for that. But it is, you know, when you're looking for nickels in the sofa cushions here, I don't know where you find the kind of money that we're talking about. And to take out some of these payday loans and kick the can down the road, it's just grossly irresponsible. And for Stacey Davis Gates or anyone to say that we just need to borrow this money and get through today, that's the kind of thinking that has left this state in the pension crisis that it has. It's the kind of thinking that got us to sell off the parking meter franchise. It's I can't think of a time when it was really a great idea.
Well, the answer to closing schools is to have a more responsible plan for it. It is a community anchor. What are the ways to repurpose the building so it remains a community anchor? Maybe that would allow for a sort of, let's say, school within a school or school within a mental health clinic or however you want to repurpose the building so that kids could still be served within their community. But maybe it's finding other kinds of community service. Maybe it's creating a network of homeschooling opportunities where kids have a community and there are local leaders who can help facilitate that. Or I don't know. But you have to think about what you're going to do with the building, what you're going to do with the kids. Like I said, sending them to other neighborhoods where they cross gang lines, which is what happened when those schools closed. It's too big a risk and not well thought out, even though they escorted them. That was no way to go to school for a young child. So it again, I just think it has to be turned around as a conversation. Leave it open or close it and move the kids is the old conversation. It didn't work. What's the new way to be more economical about that? And then you could carry that out to administration. What are the central services in the... And I know the school board in my lifetime anyway has gone back and forth from decentralizing to recentralizing. But there are partners who could help run some school services better than they're run now. Payroll, for example, ask any teacher about that system, and I think they'd like another way that could be done. But we have to think more comprehensively about how to reorganize the district.
One really, really interesting practical example right now: if you're a charter school that has a lot of kids who want to go to your school and you're full, you cannot rent space in the empty Chicago public school buildings to serve your school. And if you were to simply allow that, you would have a new revenue stream for Chicago Public Schools, and you would actually have these buildings, some of them at least, with like a bustling actual community. And this nature of like, oh, this building is a community anchor, and they've been underfunded forever, and we have to invest in them before, you know, we give up on these schools. I look at Douglas High School, where you have on the west side, you've got 35 students served by 32 full-time staff. It's more than $60,000 a year per student spending at that school. That is not that is stealing money from places it could be used more effectively for students across the city. And the only reason that is defended as a status quo is because changing that thinking is a threat to CTU union dues and the power of that union. And I think this is what people's worst fears were with having a mayor who's from that organization leading the city.
I don't know that school story per se, Austin. That's fascinating what you just said. But Stacey Davis Gates has called you out on social media for hounding her, stalking her. She said that what you're doing as you post things that the CTU leadership says is actually dangerous. And she was very strident about that. Producer Pete and I looked at a back and forth of what you said and then what they said, what you said and then what they said. And I didn't think any of it was personal. It was pointed. You clearly are at odds with Stacey Davis Gates and the CTU, but I think you were just calling them out with their own words. What's happening on that front?
Yeah, 5 a.m. on last Saturday morning, I got a text from someone with a tweet from Stacey Davis Gates saying Austin Berg is a stalker. And that was not fun. And she did it a bunch of times throughout the rest of the day. And all of it was in response to reporting and commentary that I had done around the Chicago Teachers Union and her leadership of it, which was not in any way a personal attack. Of nothing against this person personally. But I do think that it's one of the most important and undercovered elements of city government over the last 2 years has been the rise of their influence and political power. So what was really funny was the amount of calls I got after that happened on Saturday and Sunday from journalists, from CTU members, and from other people in the city saying, don't stop. She's completely out of bounds. Keep doing what you're doing. Don't let it get to you. Don't take it personally. And I'm not going to do those things. It's a bullying tactic and it's not going to work. So
I got to say that the word stalker is very freighted and extremely inappropriate for someone who, like Austin, is reading what she says and watching what she says and listening to what she says and looking at the quotes and quoting her and challenging her quotes. That's not stalking. And it's criticism, but it's way, way within bounds. And to use a word like that is just grotesque. I texted you at one point, Austin, just like, ignore it. You know, it says she's trying to get a rise out of you. But I'm glad to hear that I was not the only one who was.
You were not. I really appreciated that. But it was amazing to see. And the best thing was there was a CTU member who called me. And before I could say anything, he goes, I'm so proud of you. And I was like, well, that's who I care about, because she's been using the same bullying tactics against everybody, including members of her own union, for a long time. So
I think what you said, Eric, is not it does not escape her knowledge or intelligence. She knows it's a bullying word. Absolutely. And in this world of political tension that we live in nationally and locally, it's a call for others to take action or follow through. I'm calling him a stalker. He's stalking me. Come on, folks, back me up and go after this guy. It's a kind of doxing. And my first reaction was sort of a scoff when you said that word, because it's so out of line for what you do. But it's dangerous.
I'm going to push back on the use of the word doxing here. I mean, I don't think Stacey Davis Gates was doxing Austin, unless she was giving out his home address or something.
Not in that literal sense, but she's pointing him out as a figure to be attacked and calling out the dogs.
Right. Okay. That's
all I meant. That's true. She did not.
But the doxing came up in the accusation that you were doing that to a member of the city council, right, Austin?
Yeah, they had a post. This was a screenshot taken from a Politico video. And this is very notable, and I got messages from city council members about it, which is why I posted it. Byron Sigcho Lopez, who's a city council member, Democratic Socialist, was at the DNC, and he participated, if you all remember, I think this was on the last day of DNC, I think it was on a Friday, there was a sit-in protesting the lack of a Palestinian-American speaker at the DNC. And I think it lasted about 24 hours. And Byron Sigel Lopez, a sitting elected official, was a member of that, which is noteworthy, regardless of whether you think that that's a very noble and important thing to do, or you think it was, or you disagree with what he did. That's an important newsworthy thing. And so I posted that. And,
did you comment on it with your post? Did you say, look at this guy?
I
mean, or
I gave context of this is the alderman, Byron Sigel Lopez. And critically, and this is what city council members were talking to me about, is Brandon Johnson is pressuring the city council right now to make Byron Sigel Lopez the head of the zoning committee, which is very, very powerful chairmanship in the city council. So I simply noted this person, elected official, is participating in this. Brandon Johnson is currently lobbying to give him this leadership position.
Did you include his social security number?
I did not.
What is the what is the understood definition of doxing? To me, it's providing to the masses a way to personally find, to personally access the person, their phone number, their street address, more than their email address. It's kind of like Marge said, if you wanted to get this guy, here's how you do it. Here's how you can find them, right? You didn't do that for Stacey Davis Gates, and you didn't do it for Sigel Lopez.
The point is a bullying tactic. The point is to say, oh, this person's weird. You should ostracize this person. This person's dangerous. What I was encouraged by is I don't think it worked at all. And I see no signs that it did. So she can keep doing it. But it makes me, it increases my resolve to keep talking about these.
Not to exaggerate this, but I've been called out on social media before where they say, okay, get them. And it's very unsettling.
I will say it's not fun to, this is not like an insignificant social media troll, even though that's trollish behavior. It's a person who's arguably the most powerful political figure in the city in which I live. So that's not fun. But the first project I did coming back to Chicago 10 years ago was starting all the Michael Madigan work. And I did a documentary on Madigan, and he tried to depose me in court personally because of the documentary. And now he's going to prison. And I don't regret anything I did to tell people about the wrongdoings of Michael Madigan. And I will do the same thing with Stacey Davis Gates.
Maybe you should be taking my challenge authority tagline.
Yeah. Well, Marge, you just watch who you challenge would be the advice for you. But what about this then? This is from the Sun-Times. It's the Dave McKinney and Matt Kiefer story. An election conspiracy peddler exposed the dates of birth and the home addresses online for more than 6 million Illinois voters earlier this year, including dozens of state and federal judges whose places of residence are legally protected. An analysis of more than 30 websites of Lake Forest-based local government information services identified the home addresses for those involved in high-profile narcotics cases involving a foreign drug cartel, prosecutors involved in public corruption cases, and so on. The company operates local news websites that critics have derided as politically one-sided operations. Kwame Raoul is suing for breaking state election law by publishing the privileged voter information held by the State Board of Elections. Dan Proft, whose name came up last week when we were talking about his radio show in town and what they said there, making fun of Gus Walls, that guy, is mentioned in this story as well. While those records are supposed to be protected, BEZ found as many as 76,000 such records still available.
Well, Austin's organization is somewhat involved in this, right? Because John Tillman, who's your CEO, is named in the story.
They named, yeah. So he's identified as the secretary of the organization. So I've not talked to John about this at all, but Illinois Policy Institute doesn't have any kind of relationship with LGIS. But I do think the story is interesting and speaks to, I think, a broader, really, like we were talking about the Second Amendment before. I think this is actually a really interesting First Amendment case, because political operations can access all of this information. In a lot of states, like in Florida, for example, you can go to the Secretary of State's office and say, hey, I want all the voter records. They will give you every person on the voter roll's name, address, and even their email address as part of that. And anyone can request that. Now, of course, there's going to be sensitive information when you're talking about judges who are deciding cases and things like this. But in general, I really think that there should be open access to this voter information.
Why?
Because it's part of the public record.
I mean,
and
but
it's important for people to be able to check these sorts of things when it comes to elections and voting.
We have 6 million people that vote in Illinois. What business is it of yours, Austin, where I live?
Well, I think it's part of, again, it's public record around who and where, who is voting, where they're voting, and how often. I think is totally fair game.
I'm not saying that
should. And this information is available. If it's available to political candidates and political committees, why wouldn't it be available to an average person who wants to seek that information?
I'm not saying that it shouldn't be monitored or validated, but I don't know that I voted. I don't know if you're going to find out who I voted for, but I don't know my address.
No, you never know. You can never tell who someone voted.
Okay, but I still don't know that you need to know where I live. I mean, maybe somebody, the state's attorney or the secretary of state, maybe somebody needs access to determine the legitimacy of the list, but I don't know that the whole state has any right to know who I am or where I live. Wrong?
Well, the political party issue, that's the core of campaign work, John, that we go out door to door, knocking on the doors of people, in my case, who we have reason to believe have supported Democratic candidates in the past. In Illinois, a Democratic primary participant or something. But that information includes the person's name and address and voting history, whether they vote in primaries or not, and their age and whatever the information is that goes along with their voter record. So there is something of a dilemma there, the way Austin puts it. But what is interesting about this to me is some names were gleaned off the list, including the name of the head of the company that released them. He took his own name off the list.
Well, they said in the story that you can petition. They said in the story, didn't they, that you can petition to have your name removed, and some people have, and that has happened. I wonder if this is just a case of these judges, including Illinois Supreme Court justices. I wonder if they just didn't realize that this was sitting there and they should have been proactive themselves.
Well, Marge makes a good point about
protected.
About the political use. And the thing that happens with these ballots, and the reason these rolls are interesting, is that because you can tell which party the person pulled their primary ballot on for, which is something that I don't really care for. I feel like that whether I pull a Democratic or Republican ballot in a primary, and I dare you to guess which one I pull. You'll never guess.
$5
you know,
right here.
It does seem to me like that, even that should be private. And they should hand you a ballot, and that you can choose to vote in the Democratic or Republican, and that is, and if you vote in both, your ballot is disqualified. But that you shouldn't have to declare your party when you're voting. I know the political parties like that, but as a citizen, I really don't think it's anybody's business which party ballot I pull. And it also does seem to me that you could have people listed by zip code or by precinct without listing their home addresses. And that way you wouldn't have to make all these calls. Because one of the things in this story talked about, well, yeah, judges are there, but, you know, prison guards aren't protected, and other court employees aren't protected, and they're all kind of police officers necessarily, and prosecutors, those people aren't protected. So why not just have it so that everyone's home address, which is really a portal to your safety, in a
your
lot
family.
Of them. Somebody's really mad at you and they know your home address. That's a problem. And so that's where I would come down on this. I would think that it would be better not to have the addresses public for anybody. And I know that's going to hamper the political campaigns that Marge is working on. They're going to have to go door to door and knock on everybody's door instead of specific doors. But that does not seem to me to be too high a price to pay for the kind of privacy we want and deserve.
Well, I won't let you dismiss that hardship quite so easily. The last time I canvassed in Southwest Michigan, I was in a neighborhood where I probably went to only half the doors. It was a rather heavily Republican neighborhood, and we had reason to think that we were knocking on the doors of Democrats, but half or less of the people who lived in that neighborhood. Now, Michigan has an open primary. So you understand that in Illinois, we know whether you pulled that ballot. In Michigan, we don't know. In Wisconsin, we don't know. There are other ways to use algorithms and data from other sources to guess at somebody's political proclivity. And if you're wrong, they tell you and close the door.
Marge, do they? What percentage of the people open the door when you knock?
Typically, we'll get 20 to 25% contact.
I'm surprised it's that high. I'm glad to hear that. I think
it's not bad, and because we've already now, if I went to every door in that neighborhood, it would have been 5%, which is our contact rate on phone banks, by the way, generally. So, yeah, I think that it definitely is part of the public process to know where people live. That's why one day I knocked on the door at Tony Rezko. He didn't answer.
Do you see the people in there
SUVs
looking
outside? I could see people in there. Yeah. They had like five black SUVs in the parking lot that served as his driveway, but they didn't come to the door. So I don't know how he voted.
John Davison, just one last paragraph here from the story. Director of Litigation for the Electronic Privacy Information Center says voter publication of registration records can have a chilling effect on the democratic process. If you're worried that you're going to face some sort of negative consequences as a result of signing up to vote and giving the state that personal information necessary to vote, you're just going to be less likely to do it, that is, to vote, to go through the process. People think they're vulnerable.
I don't have that story in front of me right this instant, but I seem to recall there is some percentage of people who say they do not register to vote specifically for that reason.
Here it is. The survey found that 11% of eligible but unregistered voters indicated they choose not to register due to privacy or security reasons. 11% of eligible but unregistered voters. That's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah.
So one last thing for you guys then. The polling that I'm looking at from Nate Silver, dated September 1st, so granted it's a few days old, had an interesting graph on there. It showed that Kamala Harris is leading nationally, not that that matters as much as it does, obviously, in the swing states per se. She is beating Trump in a lot of the swing states. But the most interesting thing to me was that gap is shrinking in the last week. The change from the past month, Kamala Harris has increased her margin over Donald Trump in almost every state of consequence. But within the last week, if you take a more narrow and more recent snapshot, Trump is actually closing the gap on almost every single state except for Georgia. I don't know if that's an RFK Jr. bump of sorts or what's happened in the last week that would cause Donald Trump to keep it close or close the gap a little bit. In Pennsylvania, she's up. Georgia, North Carolina, Wisconsin.
There are a lot of things that happened in this last week. And to try to choose one event or another and say, well, that's what tipped the polls, you need some pretty in-depth interviews and knowledge in order to do that. And some surveys will have more of that than others. You could also surmise that what Trump calls the weave has gotten pretty old. That's not the thing on top of his head, that's inside his brain. When he says when he has all those topics, he goes to 8 or 9 topics and he weaves them together over the course of 2 hours at his rally. And what did he say? English professors tell him it's brilliant. Maybe the English professor from Trump University tells him that, but I don't think anybody else does. And it's turning off a lot of his supporters. Inside the rally, does that mean they're not going to vote for him anymore? Probably not, But there's all these things that are swirling out there. People are making their evaluation. And I think one poll after another is going to come out from now until Election Day and all say basically the same thing. This is a super close election. Mm. There's a reason we call it a marginal election. And if you're waiting for the old-fashioned bump of 5 to 7 points in a given poll, forget about it. You're not going to see that.
None of these are that. I want to just go back because I know I threw a lot of numbers out there and I don't know that I was as clear as I could have been. I was talking about the change from the past month where Kamala Harris is up in almost every state. But the margin right now, nationally, she's up 3.5%. In Pennsylvania, she's up 1.2%, 47 to 48.02. In Michigan, she's up 1.9%. 1. In Georgia, she's up 1-1. In North Carolina, Donald Trump is up 0.3. Wisconsin, 3.3 for Kamala Harris. Donald Trump's up half a point in Arizona. Nevada, Kamala, it says here, is up almost a full point, 0.8. In Florida and in Texas, Donald Trump is up 4-7 and 6-3. Those aren't swing states. I'm not sure why they're including them.
And the CNN numbers are a little, they show the same trend and an even bigger gap for the most part. They show Harris ahead 5 points in Michigan. In Pennsylvania, an even 47-47. In Wisconsin, they show her 6 points ahead. In Pennsylvania, you know, even tie.
The trends are certainly favorable toward for Kamala Harris, but as President Hillary Clinton will tell you, these numbers at this stage are not telling you who's going to win this race. And I think what it's telling Democrats is that they cannot neglect some of these swing states. They've got to run through the tape on this election. They can't, no matter what those polls look like, up or down, you got to campaign really hard all the way to the end. I think that the debate coming up on Tuesday night could move some numbers also. So, you know, I'm not taking a whole lot of comfort in these polls, although the trend is looking favorable for Kamala Harris.
I also heard focus groups in NPR, which is another different kind of analysis, of course, but among undecided voters, low information voters, who are typically the ones in the undecided camp. And there were some comments from some of them that they don't really know enough about Harris yet. They don't know for sure what her positions are. Some of that is still coming out, and she's releasing them as we go along. But that's something that I think she does have to overcome. She's a new candidate in the race.
Well, neither side seems to have changed their tactics much either. Trump is still weaving word salads, and it seems like Kamala Harris and Tim Walz are still sort of breasting their cards, throwing out some joy, giving one safe interview, and riding this train as long as they can. We haven't had any tipping points since the DNC, I will say that. And that's all the time we have for today. Guys, nice to talk to Marge Halperin, Austin Berg, and Eric Zorn. Who are you going to be able to join us, or will you be tagging along on the honeymoon next week, Eric?
I think they want me on the honeymoon, actually. So, yeah, I'll probably be there, maybe in the next room, you know.
Depends on how good your speech is.
Yeah. We are produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams, and we'll drop another podcast on you next week. All right.
Thanks, everyone. That was really fun.
That was great.
Good that you could join us. Thanks, Austin. Thanks, Marge.
Yeah, good to have you back, Austin.
So long.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.